Hi there, and welcome to another one of my podcasts. I noticed with alarm that over the over 150 podcasts that I've put up, I've only played about two tracks of one of my favourite singers of all time, Amelita Galli-Curci. She was born in 1882 as simply Amelita Galli, and she died in 1963 of emphysema. The Curci was added when she got married, a marriage sadly that didn't last. They were divorced, but of course by that time she was known as Amelita Galli-Curci worldwide. She must have been an amazing person. She came of Spanish heritage, but she was born in Milan. She studied piano in Milan, winning a gold medal, and at the amazingly young age of 16 was offered a chance to be a professor of piano. However, she also used to sing, and the family had as one of its friends the operatic composer Pietro Mascagni, who, when he heard her, he said, no, Lita, you have to sing. There are many pianists, but nobody has voices like this. So off she went to create her career, and she was mainly self-taught. She took very few lessons really early on, and so it just shows you sometimes if you're that good, then you don't need anybody to teach you. She made her debut in 1906 in Rigoletto, became one of her handshake roles, and she became known for the wonderful sound of her voice, just the tonal quality, as well as, of course, the fact that she was one of the great coloraturas. This at a time when all the new sopranos were verismo orientated and wanted to be dramatic and spinto singers. In a way, she was a throwback to an earlier period. She immediately had success in Europe, Russia, and South America, and only in 1915 did she go to the USA, where she immediately again had great success in Chicago and later on in New York, by which time she was already in her 30s. She started making records a year or so later, and these records, of course, made her a worldwide name, a name which continues to this very day. As I said, she's mainly known for her coloratura singing, but she could also just sing a beautiful, apparently simple song and make it sound wonderful. Her career ended, unfortunately, just about after the introduction of recording microphones into the studio. This was because she had a benign growth in her throat, which gradually took away her ability to sing her top notes, especially after she had an operation to remove it where some damage was done. And she went on singing for a while, concerts, but stopped recording, and by 1935 the career was over. No doubt she was able to enjoy herself at home playing the piano. She did have a few pupils as well, but basically that was it, and she spent the last 25, 30 years of her life happily wandering about, I suppose, being a bit of a celebrity. She is one of the great singers. This track that I'm going to give you was one of her first recordings. It's not one of her performances full of top notes and trills and decorations. This is a very simple song, or apparently so. Massenet, at his best, came up with heart-rendingly gorgeous melodies. In a way, he's a sort of French equivalent of Puccini. This, I think, is one of his finest songs. It's called Crépuscule, and Galli-Curci sings it gorgeously. I don't think very many people recorded this song. I have a feeling it's rather more difficult to sing than is perhaps apparent here. Just out of an extra interest, about 30 seconds in, wherever she was recording, must have been very near a factory, and it must have been lunchtime, because if you listen really carefully, just as she's finishing the first verse, you can hear way in the background a sort of horn telling the people working at that factory that it was lunchtime. It sort of adds to its effect. You feel, in a sense, that you're there. But, of course, it wouldn't have been put out had this horn been really obtrusive. Strange how some recordings back then that sound perfectly okay to us were destroyed or never issued, and others with obvious faults like that came out nonetheless. Thank goodness they didn't destroy this one. It's gorgeous. Amelita Galli-Curci singing Crépuscule by Massenet back in 1918.
Thank you.
Amelita Gallicorchi. Her voice was described by another great soprano, Geraldine Farrar, as a nightingale singing in its sleep. And I think I understand precisely what she meant. However, let's move to a completely different sort of performance. There's always been an abundance of two-man performers of vaguely comic songs. When I was young, there was a famous duo called Flanders and Swann. Back in the USA in the 20s, there were a couple called the Happiness Boys. The ones I prefer of all of them, probably Flotsam and Jetsam, who name themselves after different things that get thrown up after a shipwreck in the sea. I suppose it was easier to remember the words Mr. Flotsam and Mr. Jetsam than their real names. The English part of this duo was Bentley Collingwood Hilliam, often just B.C. Hilliam. He was born in 1890 and survived till 1968, and he played the piano, had the high voice, and often made up the songs and the lyrics. He sang with Malcolm McEachin, who was Australian, born in 1883 and survived till 1945, and he was already renowned with a wonderful, really deep bass voice, and he had another career as a serious singer of songs. They got together in 1926, probably just as the BBC was getting going, and of course at that time you had to be really careful what you sang on the BBC because of a high level of censorship. And what they did was perfectly acceptable on the radio, and that's probably why for the next 15 years they were very, very famous. The song I'm going to give you is really all about prohibition, which was brought in the USA in 1920 and lasted till 1933. It was brought in by pressure from the usual religious right to do that sort of thing, and it led to absolute disaster. The rise of gangsters, crime of all sorts from just about everybody, and of course it had to be rescinded. It never happened in the UK, and probably one of the reasons is that during World War One, the hours of being able to buy alcohol were restricted because they needed workers to remain sober since they were manufacturing things for use by soldiers in World War One. However, it took till about 2010 before those restrictions were lifted. As I often say to people, it took them about a century to realise that World War One was over and that we'd won, and that therefore people could actually drink after 11 o'clock at night. Despite the fact, however, that we had these restrictions, you could always buy your pint of beer or whatever in the local pub. And this song that they're singing, which is based on an old English song called Simon the Cellarer, really celebrates the fact that we in England could still buy alcohol legally, whereas in the USA it was impossible and you had to go to a speakeasy. When this was recorded, prohibition was still in operation. It was in fact recorded on the 25th of October 1929. This is a typical song of the output of Mr. Flotsam and Mr. Jetsam. Oh, and let me apologise in advance for the condition of this record. We don't always manage to get a copy of the 78 in pristine condition. This one's a bit ropey, but I think it's still enjoyable. Flotsam and Jetsam.
Oh, Mr. Simon.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Simon of the USA.
That me?
They say you're a big man over there.
Quite right, young fellow, I'm a millionaire.
Mr. Simon.
Well, sir.
I'm a reporter on the Weekly Star.
You are?
I'd like to have a story we could run with a cut.
Why, stories are the only things I've nothing else but.
Then will you tell the Star exactly who you are?
Oh, Simon the Cellarer, he was my dad. You've heard of him, no doubt. Ah, if you please, was his favorite lad, till he finally threw me out. I forget what the row was about. I went to America over the sea. No emigrant ever was poorer than me. And today I'm worth more than a million and a half. Do you wonder, young newspaper scribe, that I laugh? Oh, I've got more dough than Simon the Cellarer ever could show.
But Mr. Simon.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Simon of the USA.
Proceed.
So Simon the Cellarer was your dad.
Yes, and I'm a cellar too, my lad.
But Mr. Simon.
Well, sir.
Are there cellars in America now?
And how?
But I thought prohibition was still in force.
So it is, with the accent on the skill of force.
Then Simon the cellar's game is known by a different name.
I'm Simon the bootlegger, chief of a gang of daredevil rum-running thugs. I can get all the illicit liquor you want, and dodging the federal tugs, I take all kinds of money from mugs. I control all the speakeasies, I'm at a boy. Too dangerous a guy for the cops to annoy. When I die, they'll be passing me coffin for hours, and $10,000 won't purchase the flowers. Ho, 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 I'm a likely knave to make Simon the cellarer turn in his grave.
Ho, 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 but just the same, I'd rather have Simon the cellarer's game. For in England we still have a liberty which is free from conscience stains. And our brewers and publicans, when they get rich, don't do so on ill-gotten gains. They don't have to have criminal brains.
Oh, ho, 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 we don't have to go to the cellar below for a spot, you know. Oh, ho, 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 we chuckle and crow like Simon the cellarer.
Now, while we all remember now the big name bands such as Benny Goodman, Artie Shaw, Duke Ellington, Count Basie, and there are several famous British dance bands such as Jack Hilton that we remember all these decades later, there were lots and lots and lots of quite successful bands, not necessarily jazz bands, usually we might say dance bands, who were famous in their own day but are now sort of forgotten except by record collectors. One of these was run by a gentleman born with the name Benjamin Anselovich. Can't think why he changed his name. And he became known as Ben Burney, and he ran a successful band. He was born in 1891 and survived only till 1943, so he died in his early 50s. He started out as a violinist and gradually was attracted to this new world of jazz and dance music, formed a band, and it wasn't long before he was able to put this band on the radio. Whereas in England we had to deal with the BBC and censorship, over in the USA they had to put on shows that suited their sponsors because everything was commercial. Looking at the people that sponsored Ben Burney's band, you get companies like US Rubber, Bromo Seltzer, Wrigley's Gum, and all sorts of people like that. So they had to have a program which suited what those sponsors wanted, and they put together a sort of variety show with comedy and music, and you can imagine what it was for the time in the USA. The equivalent dance bands in England would produce the comedy themselves, and there would be novelty songs as well as what you might call purely music items. These bands were never great bands like Duke Ellington, but obviously the people in them had to be really professional musicians, or they couldn't have dealt with everything that was thrown at them, probably with very little rehearsal. This is one of the examples of the sort of novelty song that Ben Burney would come up with. We all know the name Mickey Mouse, but Mickey Mouse only appeared in the late 20s. So in the early 30s, Mickey Mouse and Minnie Mouse were pretty much new kids on the block, we might say. And therefore, this little inoffensive number featured a lyric that was all about Mickey and Minnie Mouse. It was recorded on the 19th of September 1933. It's not going to change the world's music, but this is typical of the sort of thing you might hear on the radio back at that time. Ben Burney's orchestra, Mickey Mouse and Minnie's in Town. Thank you.
bells are ringing, everybody singing, pink confetti raining down. Kids are turning somersaults, and even Grandma wants a waltz. What a celebration, we will show the nation, folks are here from miles around. No one's home a napping, cause they're wondering what will happen, cause Mickey Mouse and Minnie's in town.
Hello, hello, this is Mickey Mouse speaking, we're on the phonogram. Hello, hello, this is Minnie speaking, don't make me laugh.
Look at Mickey Raffle, Minnie off a trestle, while he knocks the villain down. Boy, wash your face and finish up, you better eat your spinach up.
Mickey Mouse and Minnie's in town.
Minnie's Mickey is cute and tricky, and though he isn't so tall, in the hero's great hall, he's the mouster of them all. Just for him, the snails wag their tails and potatoes open their eyes. Why, they look at him with surprise. Mickey's mouster of them all.
It's probably a fair generalization to make if I were to say that operatic collectors of 78 probably treasure Russian records more than any other nationality of recording. The reason for this is probably that until 1989, it was very difficult to get hold of these records because there was still the USSR and, of course, the Iron Curtain. After that, though, when the wall came down and Russia was on its own, a lot of Russians sold their operatic records to the West just to make some money, so they're no longer anywhere near as rare as they once were. That said, the cachet seems to remain. Russia was also one of the first countries to be invaded by recording. One of the first companies to get there was Pate. You know, we call the recording machine a gramophone, which of course is a brand name. But in Russia, the first company to really make a mark there was Pate, so the Russian word for such a machine is a patefone. Nevertheless, the gramophone company did go there, and pretty early on, we're talking 1900, when they were still making 7-inch records, which to this day have no labels and of course are known as Berliners. So the other reason that Russian recordings are treasured is that they seem to have really good quality equipment and were able to make high quality recording really early on. A lot of early Russian vocal records are really clear considering how old they are. That said, if we look at the singers from Imperial Russia, that is until 1917, there are a fair number of great basses, starting with Shalyapin, of course. There are a lot of fine sopranos and even mezzos, and of course, a list of wonderful tenors. What's missing is the baritone. There were very few great baritones. In fact, I can't really think of any. One of the most successful, however, was a man called Oskar Kamionsky, who apparently, according to reputation, really fancied himself. He only lived to 48. He died in 1917 of, they say, cancer, having been born, you might say topically, in a place called Kiev in 1869. So he was the same sort of generation as Shalyapin and Karuza, just 2 or 3 years older. He studied first in St. Petersburg and then was advised by the great composer Anton Rubinstein to do some further study in Italy, which he did. And he made his debut indeed in Naples and then Florence until he returned in 1893 to Russia and performed up to 40 different roles. He retired in any case in 1915, probably he was beginning already to be ill. He was also one of the first people to record. And people sometimes in Russia, really thought he was a wonderful singer and dubbed him the Russian Battistini. Listening to him now, I think he was a good baritone, but maybe not one of the greats. However, this is interesting for not only being a recording of one of the few Russian baritones, but one of the earliest operatic recordings. When I say operatic, it's not actually an operatic aria, but a song. It's a song called Oh, Could I Express in Song, and the same song was later recorded in its definitive version, you might say, by Shalyapin himself. So this is a 1900 baritone version of the song that was later made famous by Shalyapin, both in Russian and English. Oskar Kamionsky in 1900 on a Berliner, but with remarkably good sound for 1900, singing, Oh, could I in song tell my sorrow? And now we're going to jump almost six decades forward, because this record must have been made in the 50s. And that sort of gap between the standard Great American Songbook period and the beginning of rock and roll, the recording industry didn't really know what to do, and they put out a lot of comedy and novelty records. The gentleman who made this record obviously was no singer. His name was Art Carney, and he became really famous in a sort of sitcom that went out in the mid-50s called The Honeymooners. He played a character called Ed Norton. Interesting chap, rather like the British comedian Billy Bennett, who turned out to have been a sort of war hero in World War I. Art Carney was awarded a Purple Heart for what he did in World War II, and in fact was damaged so badly that he walked the rest of his life with a limp. However, it didn't affect his career as a comedian and actor, and even I remember seeing him on screen, even though I don't live in the USA. I'm not going to try and describe this record to you because it's fairly self-explanatory. He starts off apparently trying to sing a song properly and then is gradually interrupted, as you'll hear. The name of the track is A Little Beauty. As I say, I think it was recorded in the mid-50s, although I haven't got proper information about this one. This then is Art Carney at the recording mic in the mid-50s singing A Little Beauty.
There's a little beauty in everything you do. Why don't you? There's a little heaven when skies above are blue. Don't be blue. There's a little sweetness in a way the sun will shine. Remember me. Oh, if you take the time to understand the joys of life, someday you will really understand the joys of life. There's a little sunshine in everything you do. Why don't you? Thank you, Russ. Why don't we? Why don't you? Don't be blue. Hey. Keep it down. No, I mean, shut up. Remember,
if you take the time to understand the joys of life.
Oh, go out and wait in the car, will you? Oh, the office manager won't know. Understand the joys of life. You're looking for a fat lip? Right in the head, I'm going to give you. Right in the head. Shut up! Why don't you? Baby, baby, why don't you?
Quiet. If you'll take the time to understand the joys of life, shut up. Someday you will really understand the joys of life. Hold on. Hey, what'd you change keys on me for? Why, I can't get up fast. Will you shut up?
Well, I didn't plan it this way, but this particular podcast seems to be full of novelty songs. I mentioned Ben Burney before, and I didn't perhaps say that he had a sort of radio catchphrase. He would come on the radio and say, "Yowza," and that was how you knew it was Ben Burney. The gentleman I'm about to play you a record of was a British band leader, and on one occasion, there was some doubt about whether you were hearing the real orchestra or something of that nature. And he said into the microphone, "This is Henry Hall speaking," in that way, in case you were not sure who it was. And that sort of became a catchphrase for him. And he continued saying that till pretty much the end of his career on the radio. Henry Hall was born in South London, but won a scholarship to Trinity College of Music and studied trumpet, piano, harmony and counterpoint. So he knew what he was doing. He worked for the Salvation Army for a while and wrote marches for them. And during World War I, he served with the Royal Field Artillery, another chap who was involved in warfare. However, he lived a lot longer than anybody I've mentioned so far today. He was born in 1898, I think the same year as George Gershwin, and survived till 1989, so he lived into his early 90s. He was lucky enough, after running some orchestras in hotels, to succeed Jack Payne as the band leader of the BBC Dance Orchestra. Of course, this made him an instant national star. Apart from playing dance music and what I suppose Great Britain thought was jazz, he also became famous with his band for producing these novelty songs, the most famous ones being Here Comes the Bogeyman and The Teddy Bear's Picnic, the most famous one of the lot. This one I'm playing because, as with the Ben Burney track earlier on, this is a song which celebrates Mickey Mouse, who, as I say, was the new sort of cartoon star of the early 30s. This also was recorded in 1933. I think it works better than the Ben Burney track, but you can make your own decision on that. This is the Henry Hall Orchestra with various vocalists doing The Wedding of Mr. Mickey Mouse, recorded on the 25th of September, 1933.
Do you think you're going dashing along like that?
Please, officer, I'm going to get married.
Oh, well, that's different. Come on, hop up. Are you all set?
Okay.
Well, take it easy this time. Go on, off your trot.
It's a gala day, the day of the year. The sun will shine, the sky will be clear. The bells will ring, the people will cheer for the wedding of Mr. Mickey Mouse. There'll be ducks and drakes, a waddling goose, a chimpanzee, the zoo's turned loose, and Peg-Leg Pete's declaring a truce for the wedding of Mr. Mickey Mouse. The big brown bear will dance for all the company. The whole affair will be broadcast by the BBC. There'll be fancy hats and fancier clothes, a kangaroo with pretty pink bows, and elephants with manicured toes at the wedding of Mr. Mickey Mouse. The band will play a one-step and a gavotte, and then the fox will dance a real fox trot. Clarabelle, the cow, will jump right over the moon. Then you'll hear Pluto croon the latest tune. Preacher Man will see the knot is properly tied. He'll shake hands with the groom and kiss the bride. Then off they'll go to find their gingerbread house, where they'll be happy as Mr. and Mrs. Mickey Mouse.
Brings me to my track. This month I've been just ill the whole time. I've had sciatica and now I've got a cold. It's not COVID, it's just a cold, but whatever it is, it's driving me nuts. I'm really fed up being ill one way or another. This is a recording I made some time ago as part of a CD called Earl Sings Duke, which no doubt will be put out at some point. In 1940, Duke Ellington wrote a tune for his trumpeter Cootie Williams, and it's called Concerto for Cootie. A couple of years later, a gentleman called Bob Russell wrote some words for it, and so now it's called Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me. However, the tune wasn't quite the same. So when I recorded my version, I have sort of amalgamated the two. I partly sing the tune the way that it was used in Do Nothing Till You Hear From Me, and when it gets to the trumpet solo, my fake trumpet, the one I do with just my mouth, I were reverted to the Concerto for Cootie version. Either way, I hope you'll enjoy it. First of all, reminding you that I still have 78s for sale. Please get in touch. Please also spread the word about this podcast, because I don't think anybody else does one anything like mine. At least if they do, I'm not aware of it. So please spread the word. It would be nice if everybody could hear the great recordings of pre-1960. And with that, as always, I say, until the next time, when I hope I will be fully recovered, au revoir.
Do nothing till you hear from me. Pay no attention to what's said. Why people tear the seam of anyone's dream is over my head. Do nothing till you hear from me. At least consider our romance. If you should take the word of others you've heard, I haven't a chance. True, I've been seen with someone new, but does that mean I've been untrue? When we're apart, the words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memory, and other arms may hold a thrill. But please do nothing till you hear it from me, and you never will. Does that mean I've been untrue? When we're apart, the words in my heart reveal how I feel about you. Some kiss may cloud my memory, and other arms may hold a thrill. But please do nothing till you hear it from me, and you never will.